Hello and welcome to this Wednesday webcast on, I think it's Wednesday the, I have no idea, 20th of April or something like that.
My phone's saying the 20th, so I'm going to go with that.
Yeah, we'll lean into that. My name is Al Coates. Yeah, and who are you?
I'm Elaine Nichols, but I go by the name of Elaine Amy. And there's a story behind that. Because
go for it.
In my family, only the boys got given middle names. I mean, my sister didn't get one. So when we were quite young, my sister said her middle name was going to be Cinderella. So she just started calling herself Cinderella as a middle name. And she said mine was Snow White. And then when I got older, I thought that was stupid and picked Amy instead. So I can kind of like pretend in the online world that it really is my middle name, but it's not. I don't have one. So there you go.
That's fair enough.
Yeah,
it keeps you one step ahead of the nefarious people out there, doesn't it? Scott's not here. Scott and I chatted about coming on webcast, and Scott feels that it's nothing personal.
No,
maybe it is. No, it's nothing. Yeah. He's taking a bit of a bow out for now. He's going to pop in, and we'll maybe do a podcast this weekend. But what I'm trying to do is over the next few months is to kind of get less heard voices talking about child to parent violence, aggressive and challenging behaviour, And I know you and I have got kind of similar home experiences, similar in the broader senses. But would you be able to tell people a little bit about you as a professional? Why, you know, how you got to where you are? Because you've got quite a lot of professional experience, varied professional experience. Yeah. You've also got some personal experience.
I mean, I've kind of shifted around professionally, and part of that was because of adoption. So I'm a qualified mental health nurse. And when we started to look into adoption, I was working in an eating disorders unit. And generally, sort of once a month, you did a week of nights. And it didn't suit me at all. It didn't suit my well-being. I didn't sleep during the day when I was supposed to be asleep. So it was awful. But because we were, you know, there was two adults in the house and no dependents, I could walk around being grouchy and, you know, it didn't really matter if I was coping, it brought money in. So that was part of the reason when we chose to adopt it, I kind of thought I need to shift really. And then the other part was that where I worked at the time, they were going to bring in, you had to do 50% of your working life was going to be nights. Whereas before that, people had chosen to do nights. So some people loved it. And the rest of us had to do it like now and again, just to kind of, you know, keep the night people doing days now and again and vice versa. So it was just basically quite soul destroying hearing that was going to be the policy. And the other thing it would have meant is even on days, we'd have adopted these children. I'd have gone off to work at 6:30 in the morning and got back at 7:30 at night for 3 or 4 days when I was on days, 3 or 4 days a week. I wouldn't have seen them. So I went through HR and all sorts, and there was just nothing, because at the time they were just redeploying people who were being made redundant. So there was like not one vacancy in the NHS anywhere. That was in 2010. So I stayed up for 2 nights in a row, like crazily scouring the internet. And I found a job as a family support worker in a Sure Start children's centre. And I thought, I'm sure these skills are transferable. Because when I was much, much younger, I was a nursery nurse and a nanny separately.
Right.
So I did kind of NNEB training. So I kind of like really picked up all of when you work in adult mental health, I mean, you don't see a child, you know, most people who use inpatient services generally don't have children because they're really quite poorly and haven't kind of built that life up to have a long-term relationship and children. So anyway, some people had children that came and visited. So I talked, you know, to the nth degree about what experience I've had. And I got the job anyway. And so then I worked in a children's centre delivering family support work to very vulnerable families with lots of mental health, homelessness, domestic violence. And from there, I worked in a primary school that was kind of connected to the children's centre.
Can I ask you then, was prior to when you started to do that early help work and started to work in sort of into the community and a lot more diverse families, did you start to see sort of this kind of phenomenon of, I mean, we've all know that some people struggle to look after their children, but this is something different. Did you start to see this sort of stuff, you know, difficult, self-destructive, challenging behaviour from children?
Yes. It's very different from what I'm doing now, though, because I want to be very careful with wording, but the vulnerability of the adults was really quite extreme at points, you know. Like, for example, one of the families that I worked with, both parents had learning difficulties. There was really quite extreme domestic violence. Absolutely, there's no way that you wouldn't call it domestic violence. And yet the learning needs meant that working with families in a way that they were going to ever become able to parent really quite well, that wasn't ever going to happen, you know, because the capacity just wasn't there. Substance misuse, mental health, on top of learning needs, on top of poverty, living in areas where there was kind of high crime. And there were families where, you know, it was really hopeful, but those weren't the families that you stuck with for very long. So the families that you worked with over like 2 or 3 years were often families where, you know, you didn't see a massive amount of change. And there was quite a lot of resourceful on the part of the parents, resourceful letting you know what they thought you wanted to know and covering a lot of things up. So as children,
disguised compliance,
older, you know, and started to voice more. So I saw quite a few children get removed, which was awful for me, because sometimes, you know, I was part of that process. And so I do struggle a little bit with the idea. Actually, no, I struggle a lot with the idea, trying to be diplomatic, you know, that if we just put the money that is being spent on supporting adoptive parents, for example, into the birth families, you know, that children won't be removed. Of course, won't be removed, and that should happen. But there are a number of children and a number of families where it doesn't matter how much money, unless you move in and you wake them up to feed the child and, you know, you support them 24/7, there is just nothing there you can build on, really, and that's just tragic, you know. Those are some of the families that I worked with, really.
No, I mean, I think that's a really
painful.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really valid point, and I guess it's a bit off point, but I think you see that often in the adoption. The debate around adoption is often people saying, well, if that money was transferred, and my experience is the same, is that there are a cohort of people who there is not enough money in the world and there's not enough, and children don't have time.
No, that's it. Children don't have time. And, you know, for me, you have to think, would I allow a family member or someone that I love to be the child in this situation who has to wait it out? You know, meanwhile, there is trauma on top of trauma on top of trauma, very little safety, very little nurture. I mean, I won't go into details just because it's just not nice stuff. You know, some of the things that we saw and heard, you know, really quite difficult. Children were incredibly vulnerable. And then from there, I moved to work in the local authority within children's services. So that was much more supporting families within kind of the more early help agenda as we would understand it now. So, you know, I went out more to families like ours, as well as sometimes those kind of families as well, where it really was quite entrenched.
So then I know that you obviously you became adoptive parents with your partner, Emma, and then you then sort of found yourselves in a similar, I mean, I don't particularly want to lay out your story because it's not here to necessarily share all of your story. I'm sure it's out there on the internet somewhere. Everything's on the internet.
I don't think it is anymore. I think I found it and deleted it all. My anonymous blogging.
Ah, very wise. Oh, that's all gone now. But you as a family, you've found yourself kind of in sometimes difficult circumstances and then drawn into the NVR, which is non-violent resistance. So tell us a little bit about how you then have transferred to become a, because now you're an advanced practitioner, which makes you sound very highfalutin, advanced practitioner.
In 2015, I think it was 2015, and I did the foundation course and it was paid for through the Adoption Support Fund. We had had a period of, here we go, we're going to head into this whole language thing in a minute. We'd had a period of things getting broken, and sometimes those things were people. But it was pure survival mode. It was the child at the time was a 9-year-old, and we've had very, very little of what you would call kind of externalizing behavior from one of our children. And this, for some reason, this summer, we just had a few weeks of real out there meltdowns, maybe, whatever the word you want to use is. But, you know, it was like, it was quite alarming, and we didn't have the tools. And I'm not going to say what we actually did. We did come through it, but not in a way that I'm really proud of, but in a way that for us kind of, you know, worked.
Say that is really interesting, because I think that even that conversation, even that snippet, enough people who've, if they've experienced challenging behavior, will be able to join the dots that actually the whole house is sort of dissolve into survival, don't they?
Well, you know, moving a child to their bedroom and holding the door closed from the outside because we didn't know what else to do, and there were bruises and things were broken and there were pets and there was another child's bedroom to go into and rip things off the wall. So, we really didn't have, there was no, it came out of nowhere. So we weren't prepared for it. We weren't expecting it. And I remember having a conversation with you actually years ago saying, we're really lucky we've had none of that, you know, aggressive behavior or anything. And anyway, that was kind of our first taste during that year. So because of that, I'd heard of MVR and I thought, you know, I'm going to try and get some of that. But by the time we actually got to the MVR course, it kind of stopped. It was just, it was a brief episode of something over about 3 or 4 weeks. But anyway, it got us MVR, which was really good. So we went to Partnership Projects UK. We both went together, and we were trained with Rachel Elmer, and I was sold like straight away, really. And then I went back to work. And by this point, I was working within local authority, children's services, with a whole range of families, with kind of those extremes at one end, but lots of the families really could, you know, could really do some work with, where kind of lost their way, didn't really know what to do, didn't really understand the dynamics of what was happening. So I kind of started to bring MVR into that. And then I went and did the advanced course at the end of 2016. And I just kind of got more passionate about MVR, really, as the years have gone by.
So it seems like a really obvious question, but what makes it different from, say, any other parenting course, which is about consequences and boundaries, and what marks it as different? Because I think, I mean, I could give my explanation, but you're someone who's kind of ahead of me in lots of ways down the line in with this. So what?
That's a cop out. Go on, give yours.
No,
I'm joking.
I don't come in here to talk. I come here to get you to talk.
Okay. One of the things I really like about MVR is the fact that it is solution focused. So I think that just really works well, you know, and for me, that is a big part of all of the strategies within MVR, is the whole solution focused, rather than thinking about who did what, who's to blame, you know, who started it, who finished it. You know, it's more like this happened, you know, this happened first, then that happened, then that happened, then the other happened. This can't keep happening. So what are we going to do about it? And then giving room to find solutions together. And in our experience, we found that young people do, certainly in our, it's, you know, for us it has worked. That's not to say that, you know, we haven't had holes in the wall still, because we have, not for about a year now, I think, that long, you know, but that doesn't mean that we won't in 6 months' time. But when we do, it's because we're moving. You know, sometimes something new comes along and takes us all by surprise, and then we have to find solutions to that. But usually we find solutions to things and then we walk on more positively without... Yeah. You know, that the overwhelm, the survival mode, you know, we usually find ways of communicating and understanding each other that really reduces all of that.
Yeah. I mean, I think
it makes it sound very neat and tidy.
It does, doesn't it? I think
it doesn't feel neat and tidy on the day.
No, it very rarely feels that. I think for me, the thing that I found really helpful is it sort of gives you permission to get off the merry-go-round of normal parenting. And it sort of says, let's just really, you can do this differently and you need to do it differently. Yeah. And I think that the one of the aspects, I often, if people are asking for like a really pithy way of describing it, I often describe it as kind of parent coaching, which is maybe not great, but it's very much about, it's asking bigger questions of people and saying, well, what can you control versus what do you have authority over? And some of the big questions are, I can control what I do. I can't control what my children do. And that, those are big questions, aren't they? Because they're going against the paradigms and the norms of society where, you know, we're expected to have control of our children, which for some children is just not, it's just not on the agenda really, is it? That level of control that perhaps our parents had over us. You mentioned language there a little bit earlier. Tell me about language, because I think that I've seen recently there's an awful lot of conversation around child-to-parent violence and abuse, child-to-parent abuse. There's all kinds of stuff going around language. What are your thoughts on language?
I think for me, you know, I want to be really careful that I don't say anything that causes anybody to feel that what they're experiencing is being minimised in any way. You know, I have been on the receiving end of, you know, physical events where, you know, I've been hurt. And on those days, I'm not sure I would have wanted a conversation around, you know, language really. But I think for me, fundamentally, we can't just take the language of domestic violence among adults who... Ideally, there would be an equal power dynamic between those two adults. And, you know, within domestic violence as adults, I'm very comfortable with the terms perpetrator and victim. With children, and obviously, you know, there is a progression where children move towards adulthood. And I think for different young people, the cutoff is different. So, you know, I'm not talking about adult children. I'm talking about children. You know, that power dynamic is unequal. There's a hierarchy. And I think that complicates things. And I think it changes it for me. Because, you know, if my child overpowers me, the fact is I still have the mini. I still own the home. You know, I in real terms, I have an awful lot more power over my children than they will ever have over me. And that's not to say that they, you know, things happen that take me right out of my window of tolerance and I might feel incredibly powerless. But that doesn't mean that I actually am incredibly powerless, you know. Whereas I think with our children, children can be totally powerless at the hands of adults. So, and I don't want to minimise anything, and I'm not trying to argue against, you know, anybody who feels that they identify with victim. I'm talking about literature that, you know, is perhaps disseminated to professionals in training courses. I think how people choose to identify what's happening in their own home is their own business. You know, I don't have anything with that. But I think when we're talking about, you know, the language that perhaps the police use or social care use, I'm less comfortable with perpetrator and victim, you know. And I think labels are powerful anyway. That, you know, saying that somebody perpetrated an event, an abusive situation was perpetrated by somebody is different from saying they are a perpetrator. But I think all of it, I just feel, you know, we need to be careful, particularly as, you know, some of the child-to-parent violence material talks about children as young as 4, 5, 6, you know.
And I think it's really interesting, because I think one of the key things for me with nonviolent resistance is that it tries to reset that in people's minds, really, and about, because actually when we start to language is so important, and, you know, and how we use it is important. But I think that often that we need, one of the key things around NVR is about regaining authority in a situation. And that can be incredibly difficult, and it may have a minimal effect on a situation, but people's mental health is really important. And if you feel you do have an authority, you may not have a control. But sometimes our language can then give authority to children and to kind of position them in a place of power in a conversation. And actually, like you say, they're not, even though, you know. But again, maybe we're talking about violence from and challenging behavior from children that actually comes from a different place. You know, are we talking about a 17-year-old boy who's witnessed domestic violence as a child and sees it as a method of getting what he wants?
Yes.
That's not the same as a 10-year-old who has sensory overload after an incredibly difficult day at school and literally cannot contain themselves because of all of that neuroprocessing, physical sensation. They're not comparable things, are
they? It's also not comparable to a 17-year-old boy who's coming home from college in survival mode. You know, I think there's age is one thing that we have to think about, and, you know, neurodiversity, trauma is another thing that we have to think about. And I don't think they're kind of exclusive, you know. It's tricky, isn't it? And as soon as you start to use language that puts people in very neat boxes, I think you can lose some of the nuances of what's actually happening.
Yeah. I mean, I do often do I haven't got it to hand, so I'll paraphrase it, but there's a really well-known definition that's often probably the most common definition of child-to-parent violence, which talks about, you know, using physical threats with an intent to take control in a situation. And often if I'll show that to parents, a lot of parents will go, all of that is great, but the word intent, I'm not sure my child has intent. What often happens then, when Dr. Wendy Thorley and I did a survey way back 2018, people would get in touch with me and go, well, I love your survey, I love what you're doing, but I can't sign up to it because of the language you're using. I don't feel I could characterize my child as someone with intent because I see them as someone who is reacting. And we asked people why they thought their children were doing it, and they came up with lots of different reasons, but people were, and of course there's some people who are, there are children with intent, but there's an awful lot of children without intent. And I think that's part of what we need to take away is, are we at a stage now in the debate where we need to start to categorize, we need to call things what they are, not just this big umbrella?
And the whole conversation we've had there, we haven't even touched on what the adult said or did, you know. And I absolutely 100% do not believe that adults cause these situations. I think sometimes adults play a part and sometimes they really don't. But that has to be part of the conversation as well, doesn't it? You know, because if you've got a very stressed, menopausal, almost 50-year-old woman, I mean, just, you know, just saying,
hypothetically,
you know, who hasn't slept last night, you know, that person may well be a bit more abrupt in their communication, and, you know, and then the young person's a bit more abrupt, and then, you know, but hold on a minute, I'm the adult and you should, you know, and you can very quickly get into situations and suddenly there's a hole in a wall. And actually when you unpick it, you know, sometimes it's, there's also something around the adults as well, you know, our stuff is either, you know, triggered by their stuff or our stuff has triggered them. And blame is often not even needed. You know, there isn't a need to assign.
It's not helpful.
It doesn't really do anything, you know, and actually sitting down at a later point and saying, you know, I want to touch base on what happened, you know, we're all looking at this hole in the wall, and I'm sure you feel awful about it. I certainly do. You know, we've got to think about this and how we can make sure this doesn't happen again. And that kind of conversation tends to, in my experience, draw out. And I would say probably even when there is intent, you know, that repeatedly offering that space to find solutions to get your needs met in a more acceptable way. I would say there's very few human beings who wouldn't want to take that offer. You know, so you wanted a tenner, you know, let's talk about if you want some money off me, did it get you the money? Let's talk about, you know, how else can we find a solution to what it is that you want, you know? And that's where it was intent. So, it's complicated as well.
I think that's, I've done lots of training and actually it's 4 years ago today that I was in Coventry with you.
Wow.
Leicester, sorry, not Coventry. Yes, remember that church hall? Leicester. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It's all the same. It's all south.
Yeah.
The deep south. But one thing I've kind of constantly come back to, and I think that's where it really aligns for me with the NVR, is that it's a framework where you can, because the whole non-violent resistance, the word violence is there not because of your children, it's there because of you. That your responses are not violent.
Yeah, your resistance is not violent. Yeah.
Yeah, and so how you manage that is not violent. And I think I've probably told this story a few times, but I worked with a group of families, really eclectic group of families that were there was adopters and SGOs and single parents and nice parents and all foster carers and all kinds of people, and people shared their experiences over several weeks, really traumatic experiences. And at the end, we kind of had this conversation about, well, what have you done? And when have you spoke in a way that maybe was less than non-violent? You know, that maybe were you sarcastic in the face of difficult behaviour? Totally, you know, well done. You didn't throttle your child, but you were you sarcastic? Were you snarky? Were you screaming? Were your requests reasonable for this child because you know this child? And that's a really nuanced conversation, and it's got to be done in a safe place, but it's got to sort of say to people, you know, like you've got permission to get off the normal route for this child. Yeah. So you don't have to hold yourself to the standard of your parent or your neighbor or the woman in the shopping aisle down there, you know. So I think that's what I really like about NVR. It's this opportunity to look in the mirror and go, could I be better at this in a non-judgmental way?
We're both sold on NVR then, aren't we?
Well, there you are. And so
I think one of the other things as well, and obviously, you know, we've been talking about NVR informed practice and NVR informed therapeutic parenting, because that's, I there are other things that I like too. You know, I like DDP. I think it's a really good way to connect with children and young people who struggle to, you know, like a big part of NVR is the relationship gestures, and some children who've had experience of, you know, breaks in their attachment really don't receive relationship gestures very well. You know, gifts don't always go down very well. Attempts to give them something can, you know, like one of my children, for years we had to allow her to do all of the giving, and that was like our relationship gestures were allowing her to keep giving to us. She really couldn't tolerate being given things. And I think PACE, you know, things like PACE are really helpful. DDP is really helpful. You know, there's some really useful connecting tools in there. And I think they sit quite well together.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think definitely. And I don't think, I mean, there's often it's not the DDP group over here and the NVR group over here, but there is a sense that there is, people feel that NVR can be shaming, because it's, I think NVR calls out behavior.
Yeah.
Which I think sometimes if you've come from a position of, you kind of, someone just said that this is wrong.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, that, because sometimes PACE can be a bit, I know you're feeling angry right now. I know, you know, all of that's me, a terrible characterization of PACE. my attitude stinks.
DDP therapists around the world are looking at the screen and shouting.
Yeah. It's, angry letters, if you could send them to at gay adoption dad on Twitter. no, don't. Don't send them to Scott, because he'll set fire to them. And I think that this NVR is, I think, mutually inclusive. Lots of things can fit into it, but it really focuses on the parents.
The resistance, isn't it? That is different from,
yeah,
you know, you've got your, like your traditional parenting programs like Triple P, which I used to deliver when I was in the Sure Start Children's Centres. And there was nothing at all about understanding what was going on. Do you know what I mean? Like nothing.
Yeah.
There wasn't any looking beyond the behaviour. And then, you know, some, I remember being to a point of feeling really quite overwhelmed by the amount of memes that were hitting my Twitter feed, you know, that were look beyond the behavior. Do you know what I mean? And, you know,
parts,
not won't. And actually, you know, what I really like about MVR is you can avoid the extremes. You know, you don't have to choose between, well, if could they help it? They couldn't help it. They've got really high anxiety. Clearly that situation was so overwhelming for them. They were outside of their window of tolerance. And, you know, there's that's the end of that. And on the other extreme, you know, it just doesn't matter. They just can't do that. You know, and what I really like is there is the connection, there is the looking for and addressing the needs behind the behaviour, but there is also still that really clear boundary about what is acceptable and what isn't. But it doesn't come with a break in the relationship unless we're outside of our window, which brings us all into self-care and supporters and how important all of that is. That we've got the resilience to be able to do this stuff consistently.
Yeah.
But you know, that we can stay connected and we can resist.
Because as you were saying that about supporters, I think as well, I think one of the key things for me about NVR is it's very purposeful identifying of supporters. And I think it's resilience building, but by a different name. I think the components of building resilience in parents, because the reality is for a lot of parents, you are not necessarily going to kind of do a 6-week NVR course and move into these green pastures where everything is well and everything is resolved. Because for a lot of our children, like you said, you know, we as they get new developmental milestones, waves of new experience. So you know, they move up to high school, they reach their GCSE year. You know, they have to navigate proms. All of these things kind of come sequentially to children who are developmentally sometimes just functioning as 7-year-olds. And we got all that complicated chisel going on. So we're never going to get magic wands, but we might be able to kind of make it 20% better. And that sometimes is enough. Or maybe 50% better, maybe 80% better. And I think for us as a family,
the factors aren't there that are outside of our control. And, you know, being consistent with, you know, what we've learned through kind of MVR courses and reading and peer support, et cetera, you know, it does bring a real change. But then in our experience over the last few months, you know, we've had a young person with no post 16 placement and really poor mental health. And, you know, relationships have been intact. I've been quite happy with my parenting, but none of us have really felt okay because there's been this awful situation of, you know, no community, no friendships, you know, really low mood, really high anxiety, and services that have not been as helpful as they should have been. And all that stuff doesn't necessarily change, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that we've been discussing as a family, you know, that we've probably, like you, a lot of us, we have probably been on support service, a treadmill for like 12, 14 years now. And the reality is that there's very few professionals that are going to come with a silver bullet.
Is a silver bullet a good thing or a bad thing?
It depends if you're a werewolf or not. If you're a werewolf, a silver bullet's a very bad thing. So that's a good thing. So the idea that there's not, that often, I think one of the things that I found really helpful is NVR's helped me to manage myself. I mean, I feel like I'm an infomercial for NVR. And if you read the show notes, there is a link to some training we're doing on the 6th and 7th. We're going to do a 5-hour introduction to NVR.
6th and 7th
For families. July. Yes, July. Yeah. I tell you, Scott's blood pressure will be through the roof if he's listening to this. He'll be having an absolute cow because I'm rubbish at promoting things. But really just an opportunity to kind of unpack this in a really practical way, because I think sometimes NVR, that is enough for a lot of people. 6 or 7 hours, they go, there's enough there that can just make things better. Some people need more, some people need less. But I think that we were talking about this idea of system literacy, which I think is a really, I think that everyone who finds themselves in the grip of children's social care in whatever format, be that SGO, adopter, foster care, well, the first thing we need to do is set everyone down and, and have like a good morning on system literacy. Because we talk about this stuff all the time, don't we? System literacy.
But we really do. You know, the reality with lots of our children is that we're engaging with education and trying to access things like education healthcare plans or reasonable adjustments in school. We're trying to access things like FASD assessments, mental health support. And every additional worker that comes into our lives, it can either be helpful or can be unhelpful. And sometimes it can get quite risky.
Putting it nicely.
You know, sometimes the reality is it can. You know, when you know that this particular person has come into your lives because they have a job to do, and you've read the leaflet and you know that what their job looks like is X, Y, Z, and then you come along and they don't do any of that stuff. You know, they maybe don't answer the phone, or they don't turn up, or they just don't meet deadlines, and you know, worst case scenario, sometimes professionals, they do get quite defensive if they're overwhelmed. You know, we've certainly had experience of professionals who haven't had the capacity to do what's in the leaflet and have, kind of covered over things a bit and, you know, said they've done things they haven't, or said they'd said things they haven't said. And that's really tricky stuff to navigate, because there's a power imbalance and it's not in our favour. And, professionals really do have the power to cause a lot of harm to families. And, you know, obviously the majority of professionals, you know, don't. And I think some of the ones that do really don't want to. But it can be risky business having children that mean that we, you know, require involvement with several different agencies. And I think, you know, it's been a journey for me to learn system literacy and to avoid ending up in situations where, you know, the parent is being blamed because I'm angry because we didn't turn up. You then turned up, but you said, you know, there was a reason why you hadn't done. Then the next time your computers were down, then the next time, and actually now I'm really, really quite angry because my child's in a mess, you know, all this time that there's been no support that should have been there, et cetera. Feeling angry is appropriate, but expressing it is risky. So what do you do with that? You know, and that's really tricky stuff to learn.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. Recently, we had in this situation where we were offered early help and we had a really good reason why we didn't want early help. And the worker went, oh, yeah, that makes absolute perfect sense. You know, and we said, you know, but I really, really appreciate you offering that. But I just think it's not work right. And they went, absolutely fine. And they wrote it on the notes. They then were off sick and someone else picked it up. And there was a note that said, refused early help. So the next person comes out and they give me a call and they go, Mr. Coates, why have you refused early help? And you go, oh, hang on. This is turning into a thing that I'm like this belligerent dad who's kind of saying you are not coming. And that's not, and I kind of have to explain it again. And then that person went on leave and the duty worker picked it up and they came on again on the phone going, a little bit worried about why you're, and you kind of go, but you can see how, you know, I understand the system. I know how to talk to social workers because I am one. I know that this really matters. But if I'd gone, will you just stop bloody asking to give me bloody early bloody help and bugger off? And then I'm the problem. That this dad is aggressive, that this dad is belligerent, this dad is snarky.
You're not a problem at that point. The reality is that, you know, if services were well funded and, you know, workers were able to care for themselves appropriately and have appropriate support, I think, you know, the reality is that there is room to say, I understand why you're annoyed, actually, because we phoned you 3 times, you know. But what can happen is that, you know, there can be evidence. I mean, I remember quite recently hearing a story about somebody who had a post-adoption social worker, not in our regional adoption agency, in a different regional adoption agency. And they had a post-adoption social worker and asked the post-adoption social worker to come to a school meeting because school were doing quite a lot of kind of, this is just the parents' anxiety yeah. being passed on to the children. You know, these parents want diagnoses, et cetera, et cetera. And the post-adoption social worker came to the meeting. And by the end of that meeting, the post-adoption social worker had aligned themselves with the school, and the parent was really quite distressed because, you know, they then didn't have the post-adoption social worker or the school. Because, you know, they weren't in a great place at this point. You know, they were ranting about school to the post-adoption social worker. You know, and I've had situations recently where I would love to rant. But what I have said, very carefully said is, you know, it's going to take me a little bit of time to recover from the last few months because, you know, we haven't had the service that we should have had. And what I really mean below all of that is I'm furious. You know, I'm furious. Yeah. And I've been quite scared for the future because, you know, my child has needed all these things and she's hit 17 and fallen off a cliff where there's just me and I don't feel like I can be her everything. You know, all of that was actually going on for me. I had to word it, and I word it carefully for this person over here, word it slightly differently for that person over there, word it slightly differently for that person over there, and go and sit by the beach in the car looking at the sea and write some notes in a journal and get it all out all by my little self because it's safer, you know.
And man, yeah, I mean, it,
a big ask, isn't it?
It can be a massive ask, and especially if, you know, if you've been roughed up that morning. Do you know what I mean? If you are living in an environment where your property has been broken and you feel a level of threat. I'm looking at the time. We don't have that much longer to go, but if you check the show notes and the comments, there's a link to the training.
Can I just say something else? That
please,
before we re-go on to like promoting the training again at the end.
I'm not going to do any more promoting.
No, I think it's good. But what I wanted to say is that, you know, we're also going to include is, you know, I think families that live with children who've experienced trauma, who have, you know, mental health needs, special educational needs, really understand that, you know, this term challenging behaviour, it isn't just violence and aggression. You know, it's I will only sit in this chair at the dining table, but you're 17. I will only eat out of this bowl, but you're 17. You know, this stuff as well. And I find MVR really, really helpful for managing. I'll only sit in this seat. I'll only eat this. You know, I have to have all my bedding done a certain way because that's how I feel safe. But then it's when, you know, other people have to do everything a certain way as well. And you can end up with the whole family accommodating a set of needs when actually, you know, this maybe can move. And it's like constantly thinking about, right, okay, where am I going to hold these boundaries so that I help you to develop and also I'm still taking care of your needs. And, you know, like when children will only eat two different kinds of food and, you know, it isn't just violence and aggression. It's patterns of behaviour that can just make family life unhealthy, you know, unhappy and really tricky.
And I think it's easy to minimise that stuff, isn't it? As, to come in and go, well, just give them beans, you know, just give them beans every night. And you go, but that can be corrosive over a long period of time on a family's mental health, on the system health. You know, the system can become really quite, as you say, it can become all focused on the needs of one person, which it's not inappropriate in a short term. That's what we do as families and communities. Absolutely. We do that. But when it all becomes about that person and that person becomes like an immovable object within the home, regardless of whether they're 7 or 17, it just can be really corrosive and people's mental health can deteriorate and then they become less good parents. I mean, we've not even touched upon stuff around other children.
You can still be a great parent, but your own mental health can start to suffer because morning to night you're accommodating. And in some ways, I think this is a risk for parents of, like, you know, for adoptive parents, special guardians, SGOs, parents of children with special educational needs, because that's what the training tells us to do, you know, to accommodate the need. Yeah. To speak in a certain way. And you can end up, you know, there's a term in MVR called erasure, where, you know, you can end up as a parent, you are just erased. You go to appointments and everything is about your child. Any support that you're offered is for you as a parent to be a better parent to your child, and you're gone. Yeah. And that's possibly okay for 5 years, 10 years. But I'm like, is this going to be how things are when my child's 30? At what point does this change? You know,
I was going to say as well, it's a huge question, I think, as well, as a social worker coming into that environment, then you see a parent who is totally permissive and accommodating, which is an unhealthy model of parenting, isn't it?
And sometimes we're not permissive. It's an informed choice. You know, certainly for me, I have had a situation really for the last 10 years where I am in no means, you know, permissive. And also I'm not, my children don't demand things, but as a good parent, I've wanted to meet their needs. And now 10 years later, the needs are still really high. Where do we go? And, you know, this is where I think MVR is really, really useful. It isn't just about child to parent violence. It's about boundaries within a family. You know, it's about a healthy family setup and values within the family. And, you know, the solution focused conversations. I appreciate these are your needs. You know, this is where I'm going to place my boundaries. How do we move forward with this? You know, and I think it works as well. It's slow progress, you know, but it brings sort of change in those situations too, which are perhaps a bit more common than the CPVA stuff, you know?
Yeah. And I think that, I think sometimes violence sort of tips above the surface occasionally, like you've described, but often the high needs remain. And so as a professional, you come in and go, well, no one's hitting anyone anymore. It doesn't mean things are really not really difficult, or that threat,
yes,
you know, palpable sense of threat in a home can be, you know, you may not pick up on it as a professional coming in, or other people, family members, but, you know, I'm sure you've had it where family members go, oh, they seem like lovely children. I'm not really sure what you're talking about. And you go, oh, there's a twinkle in the eye, and you don't know how it turns when the door's shut, you know, and I've had that, you know, a lot of people have had that. Elaine, so I'm going to kind of draw this to a close, because we've done lots and lots, but I could talk to you for hours and hours, and usually we do talk for hours and hours, don't we? So we can keep talking afterwards, but if people are interested, we're going to be coming together on the 6th and 7th of July. It's going to be just a couple of mornings. It's times that suit people who've got children at school. It's going to be really really kind of focused, giving people really practical stuff. And it's a really good sort of, it's a buffet. People can take what they want. And if people want more, then we'll be able to support people to get more and get maybe a, you know, specific intervention. But Elaine, thank you so much for your time. Anything that I didn't ask you that you wanted to say, because I know that you've got all kinds of exciting thoughts.
Oh, do you know, I could talk and talk and talk forever. You know that about me. I told you about my kitchen, didn't I? You didn't mean that though, did you? I've been decorating my kitchen.
I've
covered the cabinet.
Podcast after hours.
Wrap. No, I think, you know, like you say, we could talk for hours and hours, couldn't we? But I think, yeah, with this training that we're doing, I think what we've tried to do is just split. So, you know, one morning is really about the connection and the MVR specific and other tools that can really help bring that connection that we need with our children. And then looking at resistance kind of more on day two, some of the things that we can do, you know, to try and bring change to some of the more difficult elements of family life. Yeah.
That is perfect. Well, thank you so much, Amy. Amy?
Oh, I feel so validated.
That's why I did it. I'm just my social worker. I just ooze good quality social work. No, I just ooze.
You do. Thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, never a chore. I shall speak to you soon.
Okay, thank you.